Great. Okay, Mr. Kodifani, thank you so much for, as I said, for finding time to see me. I see you've already made quite a couple of notes.
Yes, I got your letter, so if I could say I take every meeting seriously and try and do whatever preparation I need to do, but your note was actually very good at actually setting up the questions quite nicely. So
no, thank you. Thank you so much. To make it easy, I think, but it's up to you. I think what we'll do, I'm just going to go down the list just so we follow the sequence that we're both familiar with as it's laid out in the paper.
Yep.
I'll start with the first one, the theme of the book, The Best Advice I Ever Got. Mm. And for you, what would that be?
Well, it was interesting. I had to sit and think about the question because through my career, and I've been working for 35 years, mm. I've been around, I'm just turned 54, so I've got lots of advice.
Yeah.
But trying to think about the best advice I ever got. And what I got it down to was very early in my career, I met a guy that said to me that everybody has the ability to make a difference. Mm. And as a leader, you have to be able to see possibility in everyone and everything. And the real role of a leader is to surface that possibility and provide people with an opportunity to make the contribution that they could potentially make. But, and I use the word but, and I use it carefully, at the same time, not everybody can do every job. There is a difference.
Mm.
And quite often we make the mistakes as leaders to assume that everybody can or wants to be the CEO, and that's actually not correct. And in the organisation, there's probably only a very small group that probably can. But as a leader, your job is to look for what everyone or what contribution anyone and everyone can make in the business. And bringing all of those contributions together in some coherent way is the essence of leadership.
Mm.
Your questions deal with some of the very specific parts of that. But best advice I ever got, everyone can make a difference. And it's your job to give everyone the opportunity and provide them the support to make that difference. And if you can, you'll create the greatest organisation in the world.
And talking about that and looking in your own career over all these years, are there instances that you can remember where you say, hey, I know that you probably haven't been actively thinking about this advice, but looking back, is there a story that comes to mind of a situation where you said, yeah, that maybe someone didn't believe in a particular person and you thought, I think that guy, if we move him from that place to put him there where I feel that his potential has an opportunity, has a chance to shine. I don't know. Anything that comes to mind?
Well, I gave that a lot of thought. There's a book that a colleague of mine wrote around engagement with
mm-hmm.
people because he shares a philosophy, shares that same philosophy. So I shared this story for that book,
mm-hmm.
in actual fact.
And, okay.
And I'm more than happy to share that again with yourself.
Cool.
I worked in Canada before I came to South Africa, and we were doing a restructuring of the business in Sudbury in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And in 2003, the operation had a three-month strike. And I was asked to take over the operation and help rebuild morale and teamwork and really restructure the whole business to make a contribution. And the company was Inco, I-N-C-O, Inco.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, in taking on the job and working and meeting people, it was funny. I was actually at a car show for Corvettes, believe it or not,
yeah.
And I didn't have one at the time. And I met one of our workers who was there, and he had just come back to work, and we were talking about the strike that they had just had, and he was telling me that 15 to 20% of the workforce will almost always vote for a strike because they have these contracts that they negotiate every 3 years. And he said, many of us will vote because we're, you know, sort of in our 50s. We don't mind having 2 or 3 months off. And by the way, we don't trust the company anyway. And so just as a point of principle, we'll vote for a strike. And I said, well, how long have you been doing that? And he said, well, I'm in my 50s now. I've been here for 27 years. And he said, I voted for a strike every time. And I said, that can't be right. And he said, no, true. And I said, so what would need to happen for you to vote to not strike? And he said, well, the impossible would have to happen. I'd actually have to trust the management. And that made me reflect on a whole range of things. And as we looked at and thought about how we restructured the business, we made a commitment as a management team to be absolutely transparent, to be absolutely honest, and to do our best to engage every individual in the conversation within the business. Mm. And over the next 3 years, we did a whole lot of work trying to improve communications and speak direct and honestly with all employees, even when it was bad news. In fact, bad news we dealt with quicker than we dealt with good news, because good news could always creep. But bad news you had to share, be very honest and open. If we made a mistake, be the first to acknowledge the mistake, and do something about making those mistakes. The other thing we did a lot of work in the community. And one of the things we agreed as a management team, and the community was, it was about a city of 160,000 people. And we said, what we want is that every employee would be proud to wear the Inco name over their left breast, over their heart, in a pub, and be proud to say, I want to work for Inco. I want to be... I'm a worker for Inco and I'm proud to be. So we did a lot. We really engaged in the community in some significant work. We funded a whole range of things. We got involved. I ended up leading what they called one of the major charity programs in the city. Got involved in a whole range of things. And as a management team, we made a conscious decision to get involved in a whole range of things. Anyway, in terms of the approach, 3 years on, we went into the industrial negotiation, which is the new contract.
Okay.
And it was a tough negotiation. And at the end of that, we did a deal. And the deal was, the good news was, it was within the mandate we were provided by, or we negotiated as part of the executive. Mm-hmm. And the union, we ended up both having to move a little bit, but we got a deal. And the vote was 93% in favour. And it was interesting, about a month after that vote and everything had settled down and we were looking at new strategies going forward, I saw the same guy, not at a Corvette show, but at a pub, and we were having a chat, and we must have sat and chatted for 15 minutes. And at the end of that chat, I talked about, are you proud to wear, I asked him the question.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I am. And he said, I'll tell you one other thing. For the first time in 27 years, I actually voted to not strike.
Wow.
And he said, first time I actually believe the company is about trying to do something good, and that you didn't always deliver good news, but you always delivered it honestly, and you took accountability for the mistakes you made. And as a team, I voted to not go on strike. That's a first. And for me, that was one of the most important conversations I'd had. There's someone for 27 years who'd voted against, or always voted for a strike on principle because of trust. And if you can rebuild or establish trust with the workforce, then anything's possible. And for me, convincing one person is as important as convincing 60,000. It's the first step in convincing 60,000. And that's been a very important lesson for me in my career.
Wow, that's quite a profound story. And now, once again, looking back again over the years of your own career, over and above the best advice that you got, what would you say is the best advice that you could give the next generation of leaders?
Well, again, it revolves around a theme. And the simple theme is, as a leader, your role is about people. We have a saying in our organisation, people are the business. People are not assets, and what worries, it's quite disturbing for me to hear people say, people are our most important assets. Well, quite frankly, I'm not an asset. I'm more than an asset. I'm someone that lives, breathes, thinks, comes in different days and different moods. So when I engage with someone at work, I'd expect it to be a two-way conversation. The most important thing, I think, from a leadership perspective is to understand that the business is about people and that people aren't assets and shouldn't be treated as assets. They're much more than assets. People are the business. Everything we do, every word we utter, every action we take is focused around bringing a group of people together to deliver extraordinary things. And that's the most important thing to understand about leadership and about business, that it's about people and bringing people together. Now, there are lots of responsibilities, and I'll pick them up maybe a little bit further, but it's about people.
Wow. Especially, I never thought about it the way you just put it, because you hear this all the time, that people are our best assets and our best assets in the company. But I see exactly what you mean by that, that people actually are not assets. But taking it further, because you just talked about trust and people, and I like you touched on the community where INCO is based. The next question is a question of corporate citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to understand this from a corporate leader's point of view. Is this important for corporates and why?
When people ask me, what's your purpose in life? And you do ask, mine is about making a difference. And if an organisation such as AngloGold Ashanti doesn't create value for society in the way that society defines value, then we don't have a future and business is not sustainable. So the first thing we have to remember, particularly as a CEO, is that our role in society is to create value as defined by society. So it has to be through the products we create, and there's no doubt in the world that the mining industry is the world's most important industry. I'll give you three statistics to support that argument.
Okay.
One, we actually are responsible for 11.5% of the world's GDP. That's on a direct revenue basis.
Gee, awesome.
If we take service and support industries into account, it's actually 21%. If we take the products of mining and how they facilitate and support other industries, we are responsible for more than 50% of the world's GDP. Without the products of mining, we can only feed half the people of the world today, because fertilizers and mechanized mining, mechanized agricultural methods have actually doubled the per acre productivity of the agricultural sector in the last 100 years. Without mining, we can only support a global population of 3.5 billion, not the 7 billion that are there today. So that's one dimension, what we contribute to the broader. So that's one. Two, if we don't create value for local communities and the people that we work with, then they won't allow us to have a future either. So social development, working with local communities, working with young people is as much a responsibility of us in our industry as it is to produce the products for the globe. Because at the end of the day, the people that have to live with the consequence of mining, the holes we dig, the land that we use to mine, the people who live in close proximity to that are the ones who have to bear that direct burden in terms of our involvement. So we have a responsibility, as does broader society, to make sure that they are not disadvantaged or the costs are not unfairly distributed in terms of benefit and cost to them. So absolutely critical. Social development is part and parcel of what we do. And without it, we don't have a sustainable future as an industry. I think it's absolutely critical. And local communities, regional communities, federal communities have a right to ask for a responsible approach to be taken in terms of our activities. So I think it's part and parcel of the job. And in the end, I say that we're not an extractive industry, because you know, an extractive industry, make it sound like it's a trip to the dentist. Mm-hmm. We're a development industry. In the end, mining companies build communities, support communities, provide infrastructure that helps other industries actually develop and grow and become more prosperous. And so we need to sell our story a lot. We need to do better, and we need to sell our story much better than we have in the past. And I think that's an expectation of society, and that's a reasonable one.
Well, you sell the story very well. I mean, because the perspective that the society generally have of mining, it doesn't go as far and as deep as you just, you know, described it, especially when you look at the, you know, the global perspective and the impact, you know, the positive impact across.
And that's our problem. But that's our problem. As an industry, we don't promote what we actually do.
Mm.
And, you know, the thing about old-style mining engineering is we tend not to think about the contributions we make. We tend to think about the holes in the ground that create.
Mm-hmm.
If I told you that mining actually disturbs less than 1% of the Earth's surface, would you be surprised?
Yes.
We create and we drive more than 50% of the world's economy. So for less than 1% of the Earth's surface disturbed, we actually drive 50% of the world's economy, and people say, gee, but you guys are, it's a dirty industry, it's nasty. Well, no, it's not. But what it is, it's a high-profile industry. And when we make a mistake, it's a bad one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's high-profile and people see. Mm. But they don't understand that our impact on the environment of the globe is one of the lowest impact industrial activities in the world, with the highest impact on industrialization and the quality of life we all enjoy. But you would never know that. So,
no.
And the accountability for that is with us as leaders. We haven't articulated the real story about our industry. So that's a mistake on our part. We've got to do that.
Wow. That's really interesting. My next question, still going down the list. If it's different to what you've already told me about people and their importance in business, what would you say is the key? I mean, if that's even a correct question to ask, the key responsibility of a leader in a collective, whether it's in business or society in general.
I think, firstly, and this is a classic approach, but it's nevertheless the right approach, I think. Firstly, a business leader has to be able to define a vision, a mission, a strategy that people can understand and see what we're actually trying to achieve. So. Mm-hmm. What does a leading mining company look like? Well, we measure safety performance, good environmental performance, community relationships, obviously making profits and returns for shareholders, investing in new things, doing the right thing by the community. It's measured in a whole range of ways. But how you get there has to be understood by all, and each person has to understand what their role is in achieving the same. So the vision and the mission is one thing, to sell where we're going. The second part is to put in place the processes, the structures necessary for that to occur. So, you know, one thing that most people, I think many leaders miss, is they're good at visioning, but they actually don't know how to put the organisation structure in place, the right people in the right roles doing the right work, working on the right processes that have to be designed specific to the task to deliver an outcome. And people say, well, that's somebody else's job. No, it's not. No, it's not. As the leader, you have to put in place the processes and the structures to make sure it's delivered. So I would argue, let's say, if I'm talking to a government, that it's one thing to talk about transformation, or it's one thing to talk about the New Deal, or it's one thing to talk about a whole range of other things. But unless you're putting in the structures and the processes and make sure all the government departments are singing from exactly the same song sheet and they're delivering to the people that count, then you haven't actually fulfilled the leadership role.
Hmm.
And that's a tough role. And finally, the point that goes under, that sits under that, is connecting people to all of those pieces and making sure they understand where they fit in all of that is that key part. And so leadership without management is just exhortation. It's hollow, it's shallow, and it falls over within 6 months. Management without leadership is uninspiring and won't move people to move mountains. You need both, and they need to be connected, and ultimately they have to speak to people.
Wow, it sounds like a very tough job. Something you just said about starting with that vision, it just reminded me of the conversation I had with Nikki Newton-King from the JSE, and she made an example about, South Africa, and she was saying from her point of view, one of the challenges that we face as a country is that we don't seem to have this grand vision of who we want to become or what we want to become when we grow up. How important would you say for a country, in just general, is it for countries like, I think America and of course a lot of other countries have always had this American dream that everybody seemed for a long time to have been buying into. How important would you say, looking at Africa just across the board, how important is it for a country to have a vision that everybody
Well, I
kind of understands
well, I
and
think I
aspire
think
to?
I think her point about the vision is a very good point.
Mm.
But let me reflect for a minute, whether it's in Africa or anywhere else in the globe, of the 20 to 30 major military conflicts that have occurred in the world since World War II, 95% of those conflicts, 19 out of 20 was the last figure I heard, are actually civil wars. They're actually minorities, whether ethnic, racial, whatever, minorities rebelling against a majority government because they haven't felt as though they've been part of a vision for the country. And so the great challenge of a leader is not necessarily the ability to motivate the majority, it's to actually make sure that the minority feel part of the majority in terms of making a contribution to the future of the country. I think South Africa, and let me be specific, has a particularly tough challenge given its history, given the past and the terrible past it's experienced. So the challenge now is, how do you make transformation something that everybody owns and is part of, such that you actually continue to increase economic participation, but at the same time, those that you are replacing in the mix don't feel alienated from the process. And that's a continuing challenge. To be fair to the president, Mr. Zuma, he's probably done the best I've heard. This is from a personal point of view. I thought Mandela and Zuma have articulated the need for us to come together as a country better than anyone. Whether we've yet got the structures on the ground to achieve that, that's a separate conversation. But the great challenge for leadership is to make sure the minority feels part of the whole. And I think that's the great challenge for leaders, not only in South Africa, but we've got big challenges, but right across the continent. And many of the debates across the continent get down to ethnic debates. And so you, again, the leader, whoever that may happen to be, from whichever majority or minority, Nigeria, you can see Nigeria fracturing on religious grounds. It may be racial, it may be religious, it may be ethnic, it may be something. At the end of the day, the leader has to make everybody part of the future, part of the vision, and part of the actions that go to make up delivery on that vision. I think that's the great challenge for leadership, and in particular, probably the greatest challenge for our government.
That's actually very, I like the point about minorities because when you look at a democratic system, it's like, okay, majority. Majority rules, you know what I mean? And if I get 51% of the vote, therefore you 49%, tough. Just live with it. We're going
One
with these
wins,
guys.
One loses. What has to occur is the losers must feel like they haven't lost, but they haven't. The losers, if we say it's 40, 51% versus 49, mustn't feel like losers. They have to be part of the process even as you go forward. And so that's the great challenge, and it's interesting at the moment watching the American politics unfold. I think they've lost a great opportunity to take a bipartisan approach to the development of the country. I think in many ways South Africa still has goodwill within the country in terms of rebuilding off difficult foundations, and so I remain an optimist in terms of South Africa because in many ways South Africans understand the potential damage you do when you exclude a group because we've been there, but it was the majority we excluded. So they also understand how unfair and unreasonable it is to exclude even a minority. So, and we pull back from the brink. When I think we're heading for a real disaster, we seem to pull back from the brink and we take the right decisions when the chips are down. So I'm an optimist on South Africa and in most countries. But that, for me, is the biggest challenge. I tell you one thing. Mm-hmm. I never liked Sarkozy's approach to Muslims in requiring women to remove their burqas. Because at the end of the day, that was such a culturally insensitive strategy to put in place. And I thought a much better solution would have been, okay, when required to identify yourself, then we will require in private, sensitively done, that the burqa is removed for issues of identification, these sorts of things. But to argue the wholesale removal of burqas, I think, is one way to alienate the Muslim population in France. I think it was the wrong call. And somebody gave me that as a good example of what leaders need to do, bring those people together.
Wow. And we've talked quite a bit about people. And people are driven by, everybody has their own purpose, whether they know it or they don't, and whatever it is, really. How would you say, from a leadership perspective, how would you say, or let me rephrase the question, how important is it, if it is, for a leader to understand intrinsic drivers of, especially people that a leader has an opportunity to deal with directly? Because obviously in a company that has thousands of employees, you wouldn't know everybody's intrinsic drive. And so the question is, how important is it for a leader to understand those drivers in order to get the best out of people, so that they want to support the vision and they commit to work with the leader to achieve that goal, whatever that is?
Well, I think if I can say it as simply as I can, I think that is the nature of the work. You know, our job is to understand those intrinsic drivers. And so setting a vision that sits above and is so obvious that no one really is going to argue the vision is a first step.
Mm-hmm.
What you don't want to be doing is debating a vision that doesn't appear to be relevant to anyone. It has to be something that we can all aspire to, and I think that's important. So the vision mission work is important, not so much for the words, but it's the process is absolutely critical. And then ultimately, it has to appeal to the people that it has to feel like something they want to do and be part of. So I think that's critically important. Understanding the people you work with on a direct basis, what personally motivates them, I think is the role of leadership. And it's interesting, I went to Brazil and I said to the Brazilians before the 2010 World Cup that if you look at the soccer talent in Brazil, I cannot, and Brazil I think has won 4 or 5 World Cups. And I said, given the talent you have there, I can't understand why you don't win every World Cup. And they all laughed. And there was a crowd of about 300. And the comment came back, yes, but we've got many prima donnas. And I said, well, what was the key when you won? We had a strong coach who understood and made them work as a team. So understanding what drives individuals and bringing them in to be part of something greater is the challenge for a leader. So you have to understand what the intrinsic drivers are for individuals in appealing and understanding how to bring them into be part of the team, not in spite of, but because of who they are. And the minute you can do that, bring a team together, then they'll become the part of creating something greater where any one individual is prepared to sacrifice themselves for the success of the team. That's when you know you've got a team. When an individual is prepared to sacrifice their own personal achievement for the achievement of the team, that's a team. And that's what you've got to try and do and understand what it takes to get someone engaged, for them to want to be part of a team and for them to make that personal sacrifice.
I think Ronaldo's going to have his work cut out tonight and carry that whole Portuguese team. I'm going to skip one of the questions. We'll come back to it if time allows us. I want to talk about something that I hear from the gurus that a lot of people, that it is a challenge for a lot of people, this thing called failure.
Yeah.
You know, there's a whole lot of talk about the fear of failure and how it stunts people from going for the things that are important in their lives. what's your take on failure?
Well, firstly, there was a study in the US, and I think it was reported in Harvard, one of the reviews, and they were looking to find what differentiated great leaders from, or successful leaders from unsuccessful leaders. Mm-hmm. And they defined that difference as leaders that were in charge of successful companies that had done very well on the New York Stock Exchange. What they found was, in terms of defining whether a decision was successful or unsuccessful, the success rate was somewhere between 50% and 60%. And the difference, the successful leaders, there was about a 4 or 5% difference in the success rate. It mm-hmm. was that close.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, for them, it was within the statistical error of the study. But they said something quite profound. They found something quite profound. Successful leaders made twice as many decisions. So the statistic that really only showed where there was a difference was the amount of decisions.
Wow.
So the successful leaders made, on average, twice the decisions unsuccessful leaders made. So the conclusion from the study was that successful leaders aren't scared of failure. But what they do is they monitor and are very sensitive to how a decision plays out in reality. And they're very quick to adjust when they see an unintended consequence or something not working. So failure doesn't scare them. In fact, they're empowered by failure and understand that you have to continually course correct to get to the right outcome. And so if you did it, so being somewhat interested in numbers, I then said, okay, if I assume I make a decision, if I go to the numbers and assume certain things, the successful leaders improve their percentage or the performance because they're making twice as many decisions. They're correcting 50% of the bad decisions,
mm-hmm.
if you think about it.
Yeah.
So I make it a simple analogy.
Yeah.
That means they're ultimately, on that first set of decisions, they're 75% successful because they've corrected 50% of the decisions and at least got a success rate of 50% on that.
Wow.
So they're up to 75%. So I'm going to say that it's not about being, in fact, successful leaders aren't scared of failure. They are alert to the possibility they're going to be wrong,
mm-hmm.
and they're quick to react. So my point on failure is it's only one step away from success.
That's a good one. Wow. Actually, as you're talking, I was thinking about guys like Michael Jordan, you know, in basketball, that he, you know, there are a lot of studies that show that he actually tried more shots than the average player.
Yeah.
And he failed many times over the number of guys, but also he succeeded many times over because of the sheer number of attempts that he made, which is almost similar.
Well,
to
it's getting yourself in a position to make a difference. And so it's the positioning to make a difference and not being scared to make the decisions, but reacting quickly when it's a bad one.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, if I use a simple numbers exercise, in the same period of time, good leader versus one who hasn't had the same level of success makes twice as many decisions. And if you say that in that period the first half of the decisions were wrong,
mm-hmm.
that leader's coming back and correcting half of them. So by the time you evaluate the success rate on the first lot of decisions, they're up to a 75% success rate versus a 50% success rate. So that's the key, I think.
That's quite a, I think it should comfort a lot of people to have that perspective and understand that, because really, I know what it's like. I mean, as an entrepreneur myself, it takes a lot to make decisions, because, you know, at any given point, it's like you're walking on this tight rope, you know, it's like.
But the point there, and this is a really important point, is that those who then experience failure and don't see it as an opportunity to learn dwell and in fact lose confidence and make less decisions, which in the end becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Mm.
If you're too scared to make a decision, you're not going to be successful anymore.
Once bitten, twice shy, I guess.
Exactly.
Wow, that's quite profound. you told me how long you've been, you know, doing what you do, over 30 years now, and projecting forward, you know, the question of legacy obviously is something that I'm sure, you know, crosses your mind from time to time. 100 years from today, it's a long time, it's hard to imagine. How would you like to be remembered for your contribution on the planet?
I guess, given my sense of social commitment and social responsibility, I'd like to think that in 100 years' time, people will say that Mark and his team changed the face of mining. We made it safer, environmentally friendly, acceptable and constructive in the context of society. And for example, we think we're on the cusp of defining how to mine beyond 5,000 metres safely, productively, for the long term. So that type of change would be the most radical change in mining for 100 years. So I laughed when you said, because we've been mining in South Africa for more than 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of step change, which would facilitate safe, productive mining of our resources beyond 5,000 metres, would be the most significant change in our industry in 100 years. So being seen to contribute that in terms of the benefit of society, and given the importance of mining in society, that would be something nice, that we made a difference. And safer, environmentally more friendly, we made a real contribution to society. Because at the end of the day, if you do all that, then your shareholders will do very well as well.
And I guess, just thinking about that, I think, because as you say, it's quite a radical step. It's easy to think incrementally, you know, to always look at how can we improve things by one inch, but to think that seems like a giant leap over 100 years.
Yeah.
Just that thought is actually something significant, you know, because those are the game-changing thoughts. Anyway, these are the things that are changing.
And let me say this, it's not my thought that is the big game changer, but it's the process we put in place in terms of encouraging the best minds of the industry that's made that difference. And that's the nature of leadership. Is the nature of leadership is creating the conditions for people to give their best. And we've got the best technical brains in the world working on some new ideas. And if that's successful, then we as a team have been successful because we've created the conditions for people to make that difference.
Wow, that's quite cool. And I wish you all the best at that, because I think it's great to build. I guess I'll tie this with the question of what drives you. Because every day when we wake up, you know, there are things that drive us, you know, as individuals. Tying what I've just asked you with what's currently driving you, what would you say, if it's different to what you guys are trying to achieve now, what you just described, what would you say wakes you up in the morning to want to still continue doing what you're doing after all the time?
Well, I think the thing that excites me is, in my role today, I'm even in a better position than I was 35 years ago, because as CEO I get the opportunity to make a real difference in a way, you know, in the broader societal space. So I was excited day one because of the things I could see and the things I was doing at work made a difference to where I worked. I guess in 35 years my horizon, the only change that's occurred with me is my horizons have expanded. And the point about making a difference is potentially on a global basis. But it doesn't feel like it's any more important today than it did on my first day of work, when I thought I could make a difference in terms of what I was doing with the people I was working. So we grow when we learn and our horizons change, but at the end of the day, it's all about making a difference.
Wow, that's a good one. Thanks. The last, I guess, question is like a threefold question. You probably picked that up, and it's going to be a section in the book, and I call that Just One More Thing, which is like the very last section of the book. You've read the book, and now Just One More Thing. And I ask two questions, and the first one is, what is the one thing in your perspective? Everybody is talking about the African economy, or just the whole world talking about the economy, but in context of South Africa, what is the one thing in your view? And there are many things, obviously, but I'm just looking for one that you think in addition to everything we're talking about, in addition to everything the country's trying to do, what's the one thing that you think, if we can do, would make a difference in helping to grow our economy in a sustainable way?
I think the key is ending racism in all its forms and manifestations. Transformation is absolutely critical to the future of the country.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it has to be done in a way that doesn't reinforce the world we've come from. So transformation and the racial characterization, you're black, you're white, you're Indian, you're coloured, the day South Africa gets rid of those racial stereotypes because it doesn't need them,
mm-hmm.
is the day South Africa will unleash a power that nobody will recognise in this country. It is about all of us coming together. And having said that, transformation is absolutely critical for the country's future.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, someone's going to say, okay, we've addressed, or we've started the movement, we've addressed the issues, we're moving in the right direction. Generally, the population understands, gets it, and people are being employed or given opportunities based on their merits. Dump racial characterization. It's racial profiling. It reinforces all the negative stereotypes of our past. The day we can look forward and not look back, then South Africa will go three steps forward and it will deliver on all the things it wants to deliver.
Oh, that's
good. So it gets to the minority.
I can see that. I can see how it ties in, how it makes us all one team to say, hey guys, that's the goal for all of us.
So I'm not saying transformation has to end. No. And that's the subtlety of it, is transformation is a continuing process, and whether it's women in the workplace or whatever it is, or whether it's religious or ethnic, at the end of the day, when we've got beyond that conversation, then we'll unleash a force.
And as we go through it, it's something that doesn't leave other people feeling left out. Well, we could all say,
that's it.
You know, great.
Everybody has to be involved.
Yeah, wonderful. Second one, Africa is a rural continent. And I think as the world population grows, the ruralness and the possibilities that could be done with the land, for example, growing food and a whole lot of other things. What would you say when we look at, because I see that as some kind of a competitive advantage that we could leverage, whether you talk about South Africa being largely rural, and all the African continent, what, in your view, would you say is the one thing that we could do better to leverage that part of who we are, the rural aspect?
I think my view in the continent, let me say continent, let me work on South Africa as a starting point.
Sure.
One, we have to, in terms of rural success, I think the model is wrong. If anything, in the last few years, we've dropped productivity from the rural sector.
Mm-hmm.
We've lost jobs. I don't think anybody's happy with the model as it's currently operating. My view is that model has to be rebuilt. I think we have to look at how do we improve productivity from the land, and at the same time build a base that works for those local communities. And we're doing some work with Mampela Rampela down in the Eastern Cape,
mm-hmm.
and it's forming, if I call it, local community cooperatives,
mm-hmm.
where the local community takes responsibility for certain things that occur in the community, where we help them build small ecosystems where somebody who's growing tomatoes and somebody who's growing cabbages somewhere else in the community don't go 50 kilometres to the local market to then pay and doubles the cost of their goods. How much can you do within the local context and community? So how do you set up a little economic zone within that community? How does that expand? How does that expand in terms of rural areas? How do we get the government involved in something that's more constructive, that at the end of the day, there has to be transfer of land to people in those communities, but then how do you set those communities up so that they're successful and not left to fend themselves? And that transition, I don't think, has been designed. That's what needs to be designed, I think, in terms of unleashing rural development. And I think Mampela, as a building block, is on the right path.
Wow. It makes sense to me. It really does.
So it's a tough one. It's a big one.
No, it is. I mean, it's
and not it's a 30-year plan.
It can't be done in a short period of time. I can see how impactful something like that could be. Africa.
Africa, if I go to Africa, I have a... the development of the potential for Africa is about infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to stop thinking about a central railway line that runs up through the middle of Africa. Mm-hmm. In actual fact, it won't happen like that because no one country will be able to agree on who gets what and where that railway line goes through.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be about the development of infrastructure hubs. So there are three industries that have the potential to mobilise capital into key areas that ultimately will allow you to link and create infrastructure all the way through Africa that services all the appropriate and relevant communities that will ultimately create the economic zone known as Africa.
Mm.
It's mining,
okay.
It's tourism, and it's the natural population centres that are already in place. So how do we have governments, global funders of new projects, including the aid agencies, develop an infrastructure hub platform and then make sure that mining companies put in place legs of that infrastructure to mine or to connect to the next mine or the next town or the next tourist resort. So, for example, at Mongolu in the DRC,
mm-hmm.
we will spend 40% of the capital on building community infrastructure. We're going to build a power station that has 20% more capacity than we need to power the local community. We're going to build roads that connect to Bunia and other areas that actually encourages trade and transportation. So the farms or those subsistence farmers that are operating in our area should now be able to get their product, if they produce more than they use, to another market in time at the right price for them to start growing an economic base mm-hmm. in that community. So what other community infrastructure, commercial infrastructure, can we put in place there that starts to encourage growth in that community? So how many more of those areas are being developed? Why not we all agree that we'll put 15 to 20% more capital in to build a leg of infrastructure mm. that meets, but it needs a game plan.
Mm.
It needs the investors in tourist infrastructure to do the same. It needs governments and the aid agencies to agree on how we set the population centres up. So between the three of us, we connect the regional centres with each other that starts building the spine for that infrastructure, which then transforms every one of those communities that we put this in place for, because now they can produce stuff that more than they use, which is about then creating wealth. And those communities, then it builds on itself. So what's the blueprint for the continent that doesn't need people to make sacrifices? Because if you're going to argue about a railway line going north-south, there are going to be winners and losers.
Yeah.
No, that's not going to work. No one's going to agree to that. Mm. Well, there are going to be 12 countries that agree, each that gets the railway line.
Yeah.
So Sierra Leone, you know Sierra Leone's the fastest growing economy in Africa today because it's building a railway line to support the development of iron ore. And by the way, it's an open access facility, so people who produce agricultural products or a whole range of other things can now get them to market in a fraction of the price and on time to sell product, which creates value in that community, in this community, in that community. So you have to have the vision in terms of infrastructure hubs, making it open access, how we connect these three regional groups, and there may be other activities that you can connect, but how do we start connecting Africa in terms of an infrastructure? In 30 years, Africa will have more people of working age than India and China.
Because our population is so young.
It's got the best age demographic in the world. We've got seven of the fastest growing economies in the world. Seven of the 10 fastest growing economies in the world. So if we were just to agree on some basic logics and how we're going to work with industries in setting up infrastructure that works beyond that particular area, then we've got a blueprint for future Africa that no one will hold back.
That's a massive project. It sounds to me like a conversation within the mining sector, for instance, across the continent, is something that there would have to be one vision and one priority.
I think we can get the mining sector, because they're already in many of those conferences, in Mozambique, in Sierra Leone, in Guinea, in South Africa. If that could be connected to the political conversations in creating a new future, then I think you're going to make a difference. And that way, it goes beyond local politics. It's a broader regional approach. There don't have to be winners and losers. It's about servicing all those regional centres in a way that makes sense. And you can start with South Africa.
And it would require radical mind shift, obviously.
And the leadership. But here's my optimism in Africa. The leadership is changing and they're open to those conversations. So for me...
I guess that's a good start.
I'm an optimist on Africa. I'm an optimist in South Africa. I'm an optimist on Africa. And as I said, this is not the Asian century. This is the African Asian century. 40% of the world's natural resources sit here in Africa. There is no Asian miracle without Africa. Period.
Wow, that's a great one. Okay, last one.
Yeah.
I've asked basically all the questions that I wanted to ask, and it's been an inspiring conversation. Can't wait to listen to it when I get to the office. If there's one thing that before this interview, or as we were chatting, you felt that I could have asked you and I could have gotten a great answer from you, what would that be? And if you want to share it with me now.
Maybe the one thing I would reflect on, and we've picked up the theme as we've gone, is why is leadership about people? And the way I always answer that is, there was an industrialist about 100 years ago that was asked, what's more important, the assets or the people? And I thought his response was quite good. He said, well, without the assets, if I have the people, if I lose the assets, but I still have the people, I can always rebuild the assets.
Okay.
However, if I've got the assets but I don't have the people, I've got nothing. So the people are always the most important thing. And at the end of the day, as I said, if you want a company, if you want to deliver something special, something extraordinary, it's about people. The rest is logistics and specific activities. But if you can inspire a team to greatness, then anything's possible.
Wow.
It's all about
I think that's a great place to end our conversation. It's really been inspiring and yeah, I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much for making time once